Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you today?
And we are today talking with Laird Scranton, who is going to really get into the cosmology of the Dogons, which is a tribe in Western Africa that some say may have been originally a vestige of the ancient pharaohs or the priests of ancient Egypt, and took the knowledge with them as they fled during the beginning of the Dark Ages. I don't think anybody's really sure about that, but we'll ask Laird about that. Another thing we want to get into with Laird is this whole idea that the Dogon knew about the star Sirius and Sirius B and its orbit period. And I wrote a little bit about this in my book, Lost Star Myth and Time, where we describe that two French anthropologists, Marcel Griol and Germain Dieterlin, had visited the Dogon and actually stayed there many of the years between 1931 and 1952, over 20 years. And during this time, they slowly befriended the Dogon and got to know some of their innermost secrets. And it was only when they had developed a rapport after a very long period of time that they were told this information about Sirius. And they were told that it goes back many, many, many generations, and which the Dogon would mark by masks, by changing a mask every 60 years. And they said there were just dozens and dozens and dozens of masks up on this one wall. And so the big question arises, how would this tribe have known about the orbit of Sirius, Sirius B, particularly around Sirius A, so long before Western scientists knew about it? And the answer, according to Western scientists, and I think it was Carl Sagan who first suggested it, was that some smart Westerner who knew about the orbit period of Sirius B must have told the Dogon about this sometime after it was discovered in 1862, but before the French anthropologists arrived in 1931. And yet that whole explanation really doesn't hold water, because the Dogon have this cosmology where Sirius and knowledge of its motion, as particularly Sirius B, is just part of their basic myth and legend now. And so this is what we want to ask Laird about. So let's properly introduce Laird, if we could there, Jeff.
I would love to. Laird Scranton is an Albany, New York software designer and author of two books on Dogon and Egyptian cosmology and language. His research focuses on relationships between ancient myth and science, and his latest book, Sacred Symbols of the Dogon, The Key to Advanced Science in the Ancient Egyptian Hieroglyphs, outlines an alternate method for reading Egyptian hieroglyphs. He's lectured at Colgate University to classes studying his books, and was recently invited to write three articles for Temple University's Encyclopedia of African Religion. His article in support of Marcel Griol's Dogon cosmology, based on parallels to Buddhism, appears in the April 2007 edition of Anthropology News, an academic journal published by the University of Chicago. And he's also featured in our friend John Anthony West's Magical Egypt DVD series.
And it was a huge hit at CPAC. So welcome. You on there, Laird?
Well, thank you very much for having me on today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
I'm glad you could make it, and we've got a lot to talk about. You know, this first segment is only 5 minutes, so we only have 1 minute here, but just tell us in 1 minute or less how you first got interested in this obscure tribe in Western Africa.
Well, actually, I was just reading for pleasure, and I was reading a book called Unexplained by Jerome Clark. And there's a chapter in that book that talks about the Dogon and about their knowledge of Sirius. And that interested me, and I started pursuing other books about the Dogon.
And this was just as an avocation, something you're doing on the side at first?
Yeah, just research for fun.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back to talk with Laird Scranton about the mystery of the Dogon. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Laird, before the break there, I'd mentioned a little bit about Western science sort of dismissing that the Dogon could know anything about Sirius or its orbit periodicity, and I'm sure you've studied this whole issue a little bit closer than I have. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Sure. There are, from my point of view, there are several different important contradictions to what Carl Sagan had to say. The first is that the Dogon knowledge of Sirius is really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of scientific references the Dogon seem to have knowledge of. And many of the other references were not known to modern science by 1930. Some of them were not known until the 1980s or after, but were documented by Griol by 1956. So that's one problem. The second is that the Dogon cosmology is couched in cosmological words that all have counterparts in ancient Egypt. And so if the Dogon derived the knowledge from a modern visitor, we have to say that that visitor gave them that knowledge using ancient Egyptian words. There's no real credible source for that. The third difficulty is that many of the scientific concepts that the Dogon have and document using particular drawings, the same drawings and words exist in ancient Egypt, so that implies that what the Dogon know, the ancient Egyptians also knew. And we can't really say that a modern visitor gave it to the ancient Egyptians.
Right, and just the very fact it's incorporated into their innermost knowledge and legends and wasn't revealed for a long time, it just doesn't make sense that it's modern information that's passed on to them.
No, when you think of other symbols and stories and ideas that the Dogon have preserved intact or seemingly intact for thousands of years, it doesn't make sense that they would just casually adopt some new feature because a modern visitor told them.
Sure, yeah. I understand that their language has several levels to it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the Dogon language was very hard to classify because it really is made up of what look like 14 sub-languages, or maybe more than 14 sub-languages, that have been derived from different sources. And my research is focused on Dogon cosmological words, which all seem to relate to ancient Egyptian words.
Do you think, by the way, I was just going to ask you, do you think, by the way, that they are descendants of the ancient Egyptian then?
I think they are, although it would be difficult to prove that they actually are. There's lots of circumstantial evidence that points to that. It actually points to the Dogon having been connected with the ancient Egyptians very, very early on in ancient Egypt's history. And as you would expect, then the Dogon have things in common with pre-dynastic tribes, who were there before the ancient Egyptians, and things in common with early Egypt before the appearance of writing in Egypt.
Okay, so if you're going back that far, then it could even be the other way. It could be that maybe this general knowledge existed in this area and, you know, some of it was incorporated into the Egyptian culture.
That's true, that you really can't say who got it from whom or who split off from whom. All you can really say is that it looks like it was all one thing around 3400 BC.
Interesting. In any event, your work is focused on sort of the cosmology of the Dogon, and you know, tell me a little bit about that. How do they incorporate cosmology into their language?
Okay, when the Dogon talk about cosmology, like a lot of the ancient cosmologies, they're talking about creation in general as a concept, and they don't limit it. In modern terms, cosmology refers to basically astronomy, the formation of the universe and the formation of matter. But when the Dogon talk about cosmology, they're talking about creation of the universe, creation of matter, and creation of human reproduction, biological reproduction. And so we have all these concepts of creation wrapped up together, and a lot of the terms relate to both aspects, both the biological and the astronomical aspects.
And is that the way that they explain it? I mean, how do the Dogon themselves refer to this cosmological aspect of their language?
The Dogon priests say that their myths describe how a tribal god named Amma created matter. And so it doesn't involve any interpretation on my part. It simply involves taking at face value what the priests say. And so I started looking at it, and I realized that the Dogon priests appeared to be describing atoms and the components of an atom, and describing them correctly and diagramming them correctly. And I said, wow, I don't know very much about the formation of matter, but if they got the atom and its immediate components right, there's a fairly good chance they might also have gotten the rest of the structure of matter right, and I started to pursue it.
Do the Dogon priests today that have been talked to, do they, like, actually, when they're speaking of these things and diagramming them out, do they envision them as like atoms as we do in the Western world, or do they have a different concept by which they envision it?
No, they envision it the same way we do. They describe something called the Po as being a primary unit of matter, and they say that all things are created by continuous addition of like elements, beginning with the Po. And so that's essentially a description of what an atom is. And then they say that an atom is made up of what are called sene seeds, and these seeds combine at the center of the Po and then surround it by crossing it in all directions to form a nest. And they provide a drawing of that nest that's used to symbolize that nest, and that drawing takes the same shape as an electron orbital shape as imaged by an electron microscope. Hmm. So they're, at that level, they're describing matter in very scientific terms that are directly parallel to what you can find in an encyclopedia.
Boy, this just seems so unusual for a so-called primitive tribe of people to have such what we would consider a fairly modern understanding of matter.
Yeah,
right.
It really
now,
is.
Now, they say that they derive this understanding. They were taught this by knowledgeable teachers, which incidentally is the same thing that a lot of the ancient cultures say about how they acquired skills and knowledge of civilization, that culture after culture refers to a knowledgeable teacher or a knowledgeable ancestor who provided them with this knowledge.
That's fascinating. When Griol and Dieterlen first came across the Dogon or interacted with them, I know they spent several years gaining their trust. At that time, were the Dogon a very remote tribe that they just happened on, or were they known in the wider world? And what is their status as a group today?
Yeah, why did the anthropologist choose this tribe to spend so much time with?
Well, these anthropologists didn't spend time with just the Dogon. They also studied other tribes like the Yoruba and other West African tribes that are in the same area. But they decided to focus on the Dogon because they discovered that the Dogon have such a rich history of myth and culture and had not been documented previously. So I would say that part of it was fortuitous that they came across the Dogon and learned enough about them to realize how seemingly important their culture was. And part of it was by design, because once they realized they were important, they pursued it.
Okay, well, they came back to Europe at a time when, you know, there's very much a Western mindset that, you know, the European is far superior to the African. And so when they gave this information that, hey, here's a tribe here that really has some great ideas about cosmology, and they knew about astronomy and things like this, I guess that they were kind of persecuted a little bit. I heard that, I guess it's the Belgian anthropologist Walter van Beek who said that Griol must have been fabricating the stories. What's that all about?
Yes, what happened was that Griol and Dieterlen studied the Dogon during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s until Griol's sudden death in 1956. And then Dieterlen completed their work and finished their anthropological study of the Dogon and published it. Then about 25 years later, there was a second round of anthropologists who studied the Dogon in the 1980s, and Walter Van Beek was one of those anthropologists. And these anthropologists were concerned, even though Griol and Dieterlen described the Dogon cosmology as a secret tradition that was very closely held, that your average tribe person knew nothing about, or very little about, these later anthropologists were concerned because they felt they were unable to recreate Griol and Dieterlen's findings. Now, this would be a little bit like, I compare it to a parent coming away from parents' weekend at a college, having found no evidence of drug or alcohol use. That here we have a culture that's been described as deliberately holding secret their inner tradition, and anthropologists being frustrated because they couldn't find any evidence of it.
Huh.
So Walter Van Beek first suggested that the Dogon priests, who are very obliging, simply made up, fabricated a cosmology, made it up off the top of their heads to satisfy Griol's questions. And so he was claiming that the cosmology didn't have any value because it was just made up. Later, Van Beek was implying that Griol himself fabricated the cosmology, and he based that on the idea that no one else had any knowledge of the form of the Dogon granary, which is the key symbol of the cosmology. For 50 years, none of the researchers in West Africa noticed that the Dogon granary takes precisely the same form and symbolism as a stupa in Buddhism. And so what Van Beek is really suggesting is that either the Dogon priests or Griol casually fabricated Buddhism, which is not a very defensible stand.
Exactly. But has this information then that was apparently revealed to the French anthropologists and not revealed to the Belgian anthropologists by the Dogon themselves, it has come out since, I know, particularly through your work, but also through others, that it does have a basis in fact. Is that correct?
Well, yes. You have to be careful about how you say it. The way Griol describes the Dogon esoteric tradition as working is that potentially any Dogon tribe person could learn about the secret tradition. But in order to do that, they had to begin by asking questions in an orderly fashion. Just as your child who's 5 years old might come along and ask you a question about something you might not want to tell them in the beginning. Like your child might ask, how is it that a baby gets formed? Well, to begin with, you might not tell your child all the intimate scientific details of how a baby gets reproduced. You might tell them that a part of a mother comes together with a part of the father and creates a baby. Tell them in a very general way. So this is the way the initiates to the religion work. They start with very general knowledge that's generally correct, and then as they ask more and more specific questions that are on track, the Dogon priest is obligated to give a correct answer back.
Good. Well, we want to get into some more specific questions with you as soon as we get right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden, and we're talking today with Laird Scranton. Laird, so you've really studied these issues about the Dogon credibility, and you'd mentioned to me during the break that it's as if Western scientists is just sort of ignoring some of the main tenets of these people. Can you explain that a little more?
Yes. Basically, the way that you can establish a sense of credibility for the Dogon is through comparison. And my approach is through what is called comparative cosmology. It would be as if, an example I use in my upcoming book is, imagine that you had two twin children, toddlers, who were sent off to school wearing exactly the same outfit. But when you went to pick the, let's say the babysitter went to pick them up in the afternoon and realized that each of the toddlers had lost some of those articles of clothing, but he didn't know which ones because he didn't dress them in the morning. Well, you can compare the outfits of the two toddlers and see which ones have which articles and infer what must be missing from the other toddler and establish, based on comparisons, what it is you have to take home with the toddlers to have their original clothing. And that's the sort of approach I've taken to cosmology, is by taking two or three cosmological systems that are very, very similar to each other and comparing them, we can turn up attributes that should be, that you can use to predict what should be true about the other cosmologies and establish some credibility between them because they all agree with each other.
Okay, and that's what you've done essentially with Egyptian cosmology, Dogon cosmology, and now Buddhist
stupa symbolism, yes.
Okay.
And so you can get one cosmological system to validate another. And so Buddhism shows us that Dogon cosmology, as Griol reported it, is a wholly a coherent system. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a complete form, as it should have been described if it were described by a Buddhist. Griol has all the right symbols and all the right symbolism in all the right places. And so you can't really argue that it was fabricated because it's a coherent system.
Okay.
What are some of the specific parallels between the Dogon spirituality and Dogon cosmology and Buddhist belief systems?
Okay, they both start with an aligned ritual structure that has no overt purpose in the society, really. It's primarily a symbolic structure, and in Buddhism it's described specifically as a symbolic structure. Its purpose is mnemonic. It's to help an initiate remember his cosmology. And the way that it works is that if the initiate can remember how to build the structure, he can automatically remember the proper relationships of the cosmology to each other. As you build the structure, you create certain shapes in a certain sequence, and these shapes have relationships to each other, and they're the same as the relationships of gods and goddesses to each other in ancient Egypt, let's say.
And what structure is this that the Buddhists are building?
This is the structure of the stupa, or the Dogon granary.
Okay.
And so both structures are built according to the same base plan and evoke the same shapes in the same order and attach the same symbolism to those shapes. And out of that structure comes the entire cosmology.
Okay, and give me some dimensions and materials.
Okay. Okay, you begin with a stick and an empty field. And you stick the stick in the ground vertically, and you draw a circle around that stick that's twice the length of the height of the stick.
Okay.
And each day, you mark the two longest shadows of the day that are cast by the stick in the sun. The longest shadow in the morning and the longest shadow in the afternoon, and you mark the points where that shadow intersects the circle.
Got it.
Okay, now any line drawn between those two points that are marked on the circle is automatically oriented in an east-west direction.
Right.
The line itself will pass through the stick on 2 days of the year, and those are the equinoxes,
mm-hmm.
And the line drawn between those points will move slowly farther away from the stick day by day until you hit the next solstice, and then move back towards the stick again until you hit the equinox again. So using this one figure, in the first place you have a sundial. The stick with the circle is essentially a sundial that allows you to measure the length of a day and to track the hours of a day. And these lines that you're drawing day by day allow you to track periods of time during the year. You can measure how long a year is and how many days it is between solstices and equinoxes and things like that.
Okay, let me just segue then. So if you're a Buddhist initiate and you're building a structure and you're starting this way, you're taught that you're not just building a structure, you're taught that you're also learning about how the Earth moves in relation to the Sun, the basic where the equinoxes are, that sort of thing?
Right, although it works more like if you ever saw the movie The Karate Kid. The Karate Kid was taught to make certain motions and
wax on,
and do
wax
certain
off
things without any knowledge on his part of how it connected to the ultimate goal.
I see.
Which was to learn karate.
Okay.
He was building muscles, but he didn't know it. And it works that way with an initiate. An early initiate in the Dogen culture or in Buddhism might not have any idea what the ultimate purpose is of the thing he's learning.
Okay, perfect. Okay, and so after the stick is in place, they've determined the cardinal directions, what occurs then?
Okay, so now they've aligned the structure. They are taught some basic geometry in order to be able to inscribe a square around that circle or just inside that circle. And they end up building, creating a dome shape. Okay, you can imagine that the cardinal directions that they just so they establish an east-west direction, and then using a little bit of geometry, they can also establish a north-south axis. Those are the first two axes of a series of axes. The next they define an axis that goes vertically through the stick. And based on that axis, they define a dome that sits on top of the circle.
Okay.
That dome represents the concept, in Buddhism, it represents the concept of essence or substance. For the Dogen, it represents the concept of mass or matter.
Got it. Well, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence with Laird Scranton, our special guest today. We'll be right back.
Hi, and welcome back to the Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Cruttenden, and our special guest today, Laird Scranton. Laird, before we get back into talking about the Dogon, do you have a website, or is there where can people find your books if they're interested?
Okay, the books were published by Inner Traditions. And so the first place to look for the books would be at www.innertraditions.com. But actually, you can find them just about anywhere. You can find them in Barnes & Noble and Borders bookstores. You can find them at Amazon.com. You can find them at buy.com. Basically, okay. any source for books on the Internet or major bookstores should have them.
Good. And you have further explanations on your website, too?
Actually, I don't have a personal website devoted to this yet.
Okay. Well, that's one thing we'll all be looking for someday. Okay, we're trying to understand the cosmology of essentially ancient cultures that has survived through an African tribe, the Dogon, and through certain Buddhist teachings. And it's hard to explain. You know, at CPAC, you were able to put up all these beautiful graphs, and it was a little bit easier versus here over the radio. How did the Dogon do this?
If the Dogon say that you can't really talk about subjects of cosmology without drawing them at the same time, and a Dogon priest will sit with a stick and make drawings in the sand as he describes certain concepts and certain symbolic attributes. And unfortunately, trying to do that over a medium like radio is hard to do. At CPAC, we lost projection for a while, and I was at a challenged as to how I was going to try to explain it without pictures to go along with it.
You did great in those few minutes there and until they got it back on. And I think it even helped the talk because it made us stretch a little bit. But anyway, so they have the initiates basically build these structures not really knowing that they're learning about cosmology, and then they...
And to begin with, the purpose, there are very practical purposes for these structures in their daily life, that when they finish building this stupa, which ends up having four flat faces like a pyramid, but a round base, to begin with a round base as opposed to a square base like a pyramid, the flat faces become associated with four star groups that are used to control the agricultural cycle. And so just as the stupa is a timepiece to record hours of the day and seasons of the year, the extended structure is used to control the agricultural cycle. Very similar function is performed by pyramids in the Americas, associated with the same four star groups as the Dogon. So the granary itself is used to help them grow the grains. It's called a granary partly because it's so intimately connected with that. And the Dogon actually use the interior of the structure to store their grains.
So this then takes us to the some of the information, the pale fox. They were talking about these different levels of understanding that that people have, and that when outsiders come, that they're slowly introduced to. So the one level is that this is just a granary, just a structure, and you don't even talk about the cosmology.
Right.
And then another level, I guess that's they get into the deeper meaning of it.
Right. Now, just as a Dogon priest is obligated to tell, to answer an orderly question truthfully, he's also obligated to either remain silent or to lie in response to a question that is out of order, deemed to be out of order. So if I, as an anthropologist, were to come into Dogon country and start asking intimate questions about, tell me the truth about what goes on with the stars of Sirius, the Dogon priest is obligated to either say he doesn't know anything about that, or, to, if he has to lie to me to get me to stop asking about it.
Very interesting. So this is one reason that Van Beek might have received some different information.
Now, the Maori, who are in New Zealand, have the same concept of the Po that the Dogon have, and hints of the same cosmology, and it's presented the same way. The priests of the Maori are obligated to lie in response to a question that's deemed to be out of order. It's a secret tradition.
Does that suggest that there may be some sort of common root between the two cultures at
yes,
some point?
Yes, as a matter of fact, when I started writing books, I didn't know I was writing books, but what I thought I was doing was trying to document what I thought was the form of an original cosmology that looks to me as if it were taught globally. And I'm now getting back to that point. My third book, which is now in process, the working title is The Plan of the Ancient Cosmologies.
Very interesting. And this goes with our whole thought of the Great Year, and one reason why we wanted Laird to be at the last CPAC is if you look at some of the myth and folklore, we find that long, long ago there was a much broader knowledge of cosmology all around the globe, and then this information just sort of went away as we went from a pre-Babel to a post-Babel period.
Yeah. Now, Laird, another thing that you've talked about is the idea that Egyptian glyphs may have started out as shapes in cosmology.
Yes, as it turns out, starting working with the stupa, that the stupa evolved certain shapes and assigned meanings to those shapes. For instance, this base that involves a circle with a stick in the center of it is basically the Egyptian sun glyph shape, which is a circle with a dot in the center. And just as the shape is used in cosmology to track the hours of the day or the periods of time of the year, the Egyptian sun glyph shape, the same shape in Egyptian language, is traditionally thought of as representing the sun, the concept of a day, and the concept of a period of time. And so when I realized that that was true, that the shapes, certain shapes translated into Egyptian language with the same meanings, I started actively looking to see if maybe other Egyptian cosmological shapes related to shapes in the cosmology. And what I found was that they did, that in Dogon cosmology I could come up with 30-some shapes to begin with that all seemed to have counterparts in ancient Egypt. And more importantly, that if you took the cosmological meaning of the shape and substituted it for the same shape in an Egyptian word, that you could read the Egyptian word symbolically, sort of like you read acronyms in English, like the word FYI, where the letters aren't there to be pronounced, they're there as placeholders for other words.
Exactly. And I think this is one of your major contributions in really advancing our understanding of the ancient Egyptian language. And we'll get to that since we come back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. You know, I recently read the book, a biography on Champion, and it's a fascinating story on how hieroglyphs were first deciphered. And I loved it. And, it really took a while. It wasn't just the Rosetta Stone. It was a lot of other stelas. And I think what took probably 30 years overall to where they could really, what they would call, read hieroglyphics. And I was satisfied with that until I heard your work, Laird. And I really think you're bringing it to a whole nother level, that we're not just using the hieroglyphs as letters, but to understand the meaning behind the letters, the words, if you will. And this is really outstanding. And I'm curious, when you were working on this, when did that dawn on you that how important this really is?
Well, I knew before I was finished with my first book that there were relationships between symbols that seemed to make sense, that I could take a Dogon word associated with a Dogon shape and predict that I was going to find an Egyptian word with the same meaning that used that shape as one of the letters of the word. Now, I didn't really understand what the full import was of that was until I was involved writing the second book, and I stumbled across a single Egyptian word, the word week. And the word week in Egyptian hieroglyphic language is the simplest of all possible words. It's written with two glyphs, and the first glyph is the sun glyph, which represents the concept of the day, and the second glyph is the number 10. And I understood that the word was trying to tell me that a week consisted of 10 days. So I did some research on ancient Egypt and discovered, sure enough, they had a 10-day week. I said, wow, here we have either a mammoth coincidence, or this word was designed to define its own meaning.
And so from there,
I started exploring other simple Egyptian words, especially words relating to the concept of time, and discovered that every last one of them, the word year, month, seasons, day, week, and some other words that relate to concepts of orbits and things like that, all define their own meanings the same way as this word for week. And the beautiful thing about the Egyptian word week was that you could interpret it without using any non-orthodox interpretations. If you stuck strictly to orthodox views of what these glyphs meant, there was no way to interpret the word other than the fact that it defined its own meaning.
I know. I saw the aha point at CPAC when there were a few hundred people in the audience and you were putting these up and you're basically teaching us all how to understand the meaning of Egyptian words just by understanding the structure of the symbol.
Yes, the place where I felt the aha happened was when we were talking about a word that defines the concept of gravity, and it means to fall down. And at the end of the word is a picture of a falling man. And when we reached that word, the example of that word, I heard gas come up.
I know.
And people realize that, hey, this might not just be coincidence.
Now, how does this new understanding affect traditional interpretations of hieroglyphs?
Right, and what are the traditional people saying about it, if anything, yet? I know the old school is always slow to embrace the new school.
Yes, the thing is that I really have had no reaction from people in official capacities about the words, and probably won't expect to until the books that I've written draw enough attention to sort of back them into a corner and force them to address it. I did have my second book reviewed at length by a leading Egyptian language scholar, and I actually paid him to challenge me to justify any reference that I made that he considered to be unorthodox. And that was about a three-month process and was very enlightening for me, and I think helped him to see that I had valid points about certain aspects of the language.
Good. And did he challenge you on any as being?
Yes, in some cases he would come back and say, there's a glyph called the reed leaf glyph that looks like a big feather. And I said that based on my examples, I thought this symbol meant that which is or that which. And he came back and he said, look, there's no justification for that interpretation. Of course, he didn't realize that there is justification in some of the Egyptian language dictionaries for it. But from his point of view, he said there was no justification. And I said, well, effectively, that's fine. Let's disallow that meaning for that glyph. But what that's going to leave us with is dozens and dozens of Egyptian words, all with the same missing meaning represented by the same glyph, and all of them sensibly satisfied by the phrase that which or that which is. Mm-hmm. And he came back and said, the fact that there are so many examples that are satisfied by it is justification for using it that way.
Excellent. Well, that's progress. You know, you just sell one guy at a time.
Right. But I don't really expect that I'm going to get a serious reaction from anyone in an official capacity about any of this.
Okay. So, something else you talked about at the conference was the egg and the ball structure and how this helps define Egyptian gods and goddesses. Can you give us a brief overview on that?
Yes, the egg and the ball is the same shape as the base of the stupa or the Egyptian sun glyph, with the north-south line and the east-west line drawn through it. So it's basically a circle with a dot in the middle divided into four segments.
Okay.
And that's the starting point for the cosmology. It represents two things for the Dogon. The first thing it represents is a fertilized egg inside a womb, and that's if you're considering the biological reproduction symbolism. It also represents the point of perception of a wave in physics. In other words, the act that causes the wave-like behavior of matter to suddenly magically turn into particle-like behavior. And so the Dogon explain a lot of their cosmology in terms of that figure. They say that Amma lives in the center of that figure in the little egg inside the ball. And they say the four segments represent the four cardinal or four primordial elements, water, fire, wind, and earth. And they associate pairs of ancestors who are like the Egyptian Aeneid gods and goddesses with each of those four elements. And so just as you have pairs of Egyptian gods and goddesses who seem to represent opposing aspects of like earth and sky or lightness and darkness, the Dogon define ancestors in terms of these four elements.
Well, we're just beginning to understand what this is all about. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. It's been short but sweet. I didn't realize our show is over already. And Laird, I want to thank you for being on Cosmic Influence and tell our listeners the name of your books one more time.
Okay, the first book is called The Science of the Dogon, Decoding the African Mystery Tradition. The second is called Sacred Symbols of the Dogon, The Key to Advanced Science in the Ancient Egyptian Hieroglyphs. Those are both mouthfuls, but go to Amazon and type the word Dogon and my books will come up.
Terrific. Well, we really appreciate you being on Cosmic Influence and appreciate your work in helping us understand the Dogon and ancient cultures in general.
Well, thank you very much, Walter. I really enjoyed our talk.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Crutenden, and our wonderful guest today, Laird Scranton. If at any point you'd like more information on the show, please visit our website at www.binaryresearchinstitute.org, and please stay tuned for our future episodes. In the meantime,
bring on the higher ages.